evening. Well, we've come just about to the end of our subject. I didn't bring the book tonight because he doesn't address the Eightfold Path in his book at all. He just discusses various kinds of Buddhism, the various flavors of Vajrayana and the Mahayana and etc., and then goes more deeply into Vajrayana and how to practice that. But since we're not practicing Vajrayana, I didn't think it would be useful for me to try to stumble around in that, because I don't do that, and neither do you. So I went back to the Buddha book, the Nanamoli's The Life of Buddha, because there's a very nice description in Buddha's own words of the Eightfold Path. And so I brought that for us tonight. And we did the first one, Right View, which took a whole evening because it's the biggest subject. It's how we start out and understand that we really need this. We need to understand this situation that we're in order to know what to do and how to do. So that's why it's number one, right view, is to be able to see our own suffering and the suffering of others, to have some real connection to that, visceral connection to that, and to the understanding of why, how our mind works to become so attached to ourself and to whatever we see, how we connect and we don't let go, that we're animals first, as I said, to the Wednesday night group, and they took issue with me. We're not animals, but truly we are. And it's important to recognize that we have what they call a lizard mind in the back of our brain that's connected to our spine, and it's the first brain. But if we come to depend on that, we'd miss the glory of being a human being, and not to speak of all the wisdom that we need in order to navigate a very complicated life. So it's important to know how to think and how to consider our situation and how to allow ourselves to experience our situation as we're having it, and not override it with too many ideas. To be open to the truth of things rather than the ideas of them. So the second one goes with the first. It's right intention. So it's about not being cruel. It's not to have ill will. And there are times when we do. So these are things to notice, like the precepts, to be aware of what we are going through while we're going through it, and to decide that we aren't going to try to go make that our practice. These are practice instructions. This is how to live. If you live always grumpy, you don't see clearly. You can't see all the goodness around you. You can't see what's holding you and supporting you. So it's really important to not choose for your own affliction or for others or for both, is the bottom line of this one. Don't choose for your own affliction or for the affliction of others or for both of them. In other words, find a positive way to be in the world. So intention and view are called the path of understanding. You need them both in order to launch onto the Eightfold Path. And number three is right speech, which is a big subject. There are whole books written just about right speech because it's so important. We can do so much harm, as we know. So much devastation comes just from the wrong words at the wrong time. So cultivating, Buddha said, promoting friendship, rejoicing in concord, and abandoning abuse, but speak without falsehood, slander, creating divisions, and gossip. Creating divisions in a sangha is really important. It's considered to be one of the crimes. There are only three crimes in Buddhism. One is to kill a Buddha. The second one is to kill your parents. And the third one is to create a division in the sangha. It's interesting. But we see it so often. And we see what harm it does. Because truly, there is no division. It's all a singularity. It's all one thing. So we try to cultivate, Buddha says, words that go to the heart and that are reasoned. So Buddhism is very much about reason. It's not about making it up. It's not about being romantic. It's about figuring it out and seeing how it all fits together. Sometimes we think we're supposed to forget about thinking, but that's not true. The next one is right livelihood. So his recommendation is no weapons. No, let's see, trading in weapons, breathing things, meat, liquor, or poisons. Don't make any money off of these things. Don't cultivate them in any way. So these three, the right speech, right action, and right livelihood, are called paths of virtue. And they're the first steps of going into the path, figuring out how to live. How do we actually live this? But it takes effort. It takes a lot of effort, actually. And that's number six. Right effort is acknowledging how much energy it takes just to sit, not to speak of living a virtuous life and living a life that's awake, where we're actually paying attention. It takes energy to pay attention. It takes energy to go out and meet our situation rather than just go along with everything. And this is all about going out to meet. Having the will to do it. So So it's awakening the desire to arouse energy. So we have to wake up first. Have to get out of bed every morning without lingering. Suzuki Roshi always said, don't hang around in bed and just jump right up after the clock goes off or the cat meows. And then abandon evil. And that all by itself takes a lot of effort sometimes. Sometimes more than we can manage if it's overtaking us. And just exert our mind for endeavors. Whatever we're endeavoring, do it, and do it well. And of course, we don't do it perfectly, and there are times when we falter and we fail, and etc., etc. But this is a kind of suggestion for us of how to approach a virtuous life. Number 7 is right mindfulness. And of course, there's a whole long chapter on right mindfulness. There's Joseph Goldstein has written a beautiful book on mindfulness practice, where he goes into every single one at great length. It's a very, very fine book. So it's about contemplation of the body, of the feelings, of consciousness. It's about being ardent and fully aware. I love that translation. Ardency is a part of effort, but it's a deeply feeling and caring kind of effort. Ardent and fully aware. So Buddha says, go and sit in a forest pay attention to how you're breathing. Notice whether it's a long breath or a short breath. And allow it to be that way. Put away covetousness and grief for the world. And notice when I'm walking. Notice I'm walking. When I'm sitting. When I'm standing. Notice. I am sitting, I am standing. In other words, be the body. Be what we are. And not clinging to anything in the world. He says that all things have desire. At their root. And that's, of course, in the beginning. That it's our own desires that keep us hampered. So noticing our desire and paying attention. Attention actually creates desire. We see something delicious and then we want it and then we try to get it and then we have feelings about that and then there's concentration and then we're aware of them. So this whole process is this thing that he's been teaching all the way along, around and around, that as soon as we want something or don't want something, it creates a whole chain reaction. So ardent and fully aware is how we become mindful of where we are and who we are and what our experience is. With desire at the root. The last one is right meditation, or sometimes called concentration. And I want to talk about the difference between the two because they are different. Concentration, are many kinds of practices of concentration. We stare at a candle flame, or we sit by a river and listen to the flow, or we cut an onion and chop it up, chop, 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 being very focused, very energetic. Those things are all concentration practices and mindful practices, not meditation. So meditation is a separate tradition. Buddha describes in four steps the experience of it that some people take as instruction and which we do not. But it does describe in some sort of general detail how we experience meditation. The first stage is that we are secluded from our desires. We sit down. We just sit down and separate ourselves from everything and just be here. So as we sit, we start thinking and exploring our thought and our experience. And feel pretty good, usually. It's kind of nice just to stop and breathe and not have to run around a bit, just take a rest and be here. So, here. And then this, if we keep going, our mind becomes more still, all by itself. If we try to make it still, it gets busier. It's inevitable. We often go to retreats and think, oh, now I'm going to be really, really quiet. And then keep telling myself, shut up, shut up, shut up. And of course, it won't shut up. It won't. You're dead if it's not working. So you don't want to do that. The best way is to feel and develop a kind of self-confident feeling. Oh, I'm here. I'm here and I'm fine. Whatever else is going on in the world, I'm okay. I'm just here breathing. And it's another kind of happiness that comes with it, a kind of pleasure. So Buddha doesn't say you have to be grim. You have to keep your mouth sturdy and straight, and you have to be like this. That's a kind of fake Zen. It's a happy feeling. It's a happy feeling to be who you are, where you are. To be just like this. And to give yourself a place to sit and be quiet. But eventually that happiness kind of just goes away by itself into a kind of easy feeling. But a kind of pleasure in feeling your body, of feeling what it is to be a breathing body. And to be... he says, without pain. Now, many people in Zen force themselves so hard that they feel a lot of pain. And it's something I'd like to emphasize, that you're not supposed to be developing pain, that you want to find a comfortable position that will carry you in a 40-minute sit, or a 30 or a 50-minute sit, one that won't be a torture. If you sit for long, long periods, like Sesshin, your knees begin to complain, and so you need to do a little yoga to ease it. You need to definitely need to do the walking meditation, because that just juices up all your joints so that you can sit some more. But you want to address your position as you sit, so that you're sitting in a very balanced way, and you're up high enough so that your knees and the tip of your spine are a triangle. So if you're too low to the ground, your back begins to hurt. If you're very tall and long-legged, you need to be quite high in order to get your knees down without everything else being stressed. So you need to experiment with your position until you find something that is really quite comfortable. And we have different methods. We have benches and that cool little thing that Judy sits on, and this amazing thing that Karen has invented and made herself. Anything is possible. If you need a sling to hold your arms, you can wear a sling on your coat. Anything that makes you as comfortable as you can possibly be, so that you can freely breathe. And so, though your core is holding you up, that your belly is soft, and your belly will be going in and out as you breathe. You don't breathe from up here, you breathe from deep, deep down. This is where our wisdom lies. This is where our ease is, deep in our belly. So it's very important to find a comfortable way, and then a comfortable breath. But as Buddha says, notice that if it's a short breath, if I'm going like over and over, you just have to see it. But once you begin to notice it, it begins to change. Because our breath has its own life. It's like our heart. We don't really tell it what to do. We think we do. And we can try to impose on our breath. But if you try to hold your breath, hold it, hold it, hold it, turn blue, you fall over. And then you start to breathe again, all by yourself. So this is a body practice first. This is the very most important point. It's all about being a body in the world and how to comport the body in the best way so it can do the best work that needs to be done. So as the happiness fades to equanimity, number four is that our joy and grief and pain and pleasure all begin to disappear into looking, just seeing, with equanimity, that we just feel balanced and fine. It takes a while for the body to understand and accept that we're not going to get up and run around. That's how I always understood it for myself. I always feel as if my body is saying, wait a minute, no, we don't do this. You know, I'm supposed to get up and go wash the dishes or something, answer the telephone. No. You say, no, body. No, it's okay. Just stay. Have a rest. Breathe. So it's very important to be friends with your body. Be very, very friendly. And take good care of it. It's not forever. And it will start to fall apart. Sometimes sooner, sometimes later. And then you'll have to deal with that in all kinds of ways that if you're young, you don't have any you can't even imagine what it's like. I'm sort of a living example for everybody of how you can keep going even with two kinds of arthritis and various other problems, physical problems. I was very sad when I couldn't sit on the floor anymore. But you don't need to sit on the floor. It's just the best way. You can sit on a chair. You can sit lying flat on your back if you have to. And people do. People come to Sesshin and do most of the Sesshin on their back. Samia has done that. So it's not something you do and get good at it and then you don't have to do it anymore. It's a lifetime proposition because it keeps bringing us back to this equanimous place where everything is in balance and we can be truly human, truly fine humans. So the last one is, with this equanimousness, we don't have any particular perceptions anymore. We don't get excited when we hear a bird. The bird sound comes in and is us. The sound of the creek is us. It's all flowing in our body, ourself. And Buddha says we abide in the base and are in the infiniteness of space. That it's a very, very wide, spacious kind of feeling. If you practice Maha Mudra, that's what they aim for. They love to go to Jikoji and walk up to the ridge where you can look out over mountain ranges all the way to the ocean and all sky above so that you've got this spacious experience. But actually, if you sit, that spacious experience can come to you in a little dark room. It can come anywhere. It's in us. So we're having, Buddha says, a pleasant abiding here and now. We abide here pleasantly, right here, right now. Having done all these things, we are considered to have blindfolded Mara. We actually put a blindfold on Mara. Boom, just like that. No more temptations. No more luring us out. We're just fine, right where we are. And of course, we have to get up. And that's a part of the meditation practice too, how we come into meditation. If we come in quietly, that's a very big help. Come in quietly and sit down quietly and not bustle around and not talk. And then when we get up, in our practice, because we don't see each other very often, we talk. We actually meet each other. And I think it's a very sweet part of our practice that we have these connections that we make briefly at the end of our sits. So I would encourage that. So that's what I brought tonight. 7 of the Eightfold Path. Your questions? Karen?
I have 2, but I'll try to keep it to 1. I guess one is something that I just keep asking myself about right view, which is, you know, since it's so hard to really think about what emptiness is, you know, I've just kind of, a lot of times I think, oh, it's much easier to think about the connectivity, that occasionally I have very strong experiences of, and so why are we not more focused on what it is instead of what it isn't, or some sort of that kind of question?
Oh, emptiness does not mean empty. It's a horrible word. That's the problem. Emptiness just means interconnectedness and temporariness. It just means how things... It isn't about anything being empty. It's not like a vacuum. It's saying that our form itself is a part of everything. It's not separate. And we don't have a word for that. And I don't think emptiness is a good word for it either. It's just a lousy kind of concept that is very misleading.
Well, one answer that came to me was that by not focusing on something that it is, then it can't become too big or too
important.
Too important. Or, for example, there's a point in time I will always remember during a ceremony, this huge feeling of, I've never experienced anything like it, and it's just undescribable. So I won't describe it, but I wonder if I hang on to that too much a little.
Yes.
You know?
Don't hold on to
yeah.
those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something that.
Yeah. Wait, the Heart Sutra says form does not differ from emptiness. So it's saying that this and that and every this and that is a part of the whole. So you can't say that with one word. So we have to say it with a lot of different words and try to... The thing is that when we sit, we experience it. We actually feel it as part of the meditation experience. And then when we get up, we want to tell everybody about it. Oh, this thing happens. And then you don't know how to say it. It's really untalkaboutable, and yet we feel we should somehow explain it. And you can't explain it, really. You just can't. You could say it's a blessing that comes with sitting. It's a grace. Now, I was at Yop's last week and asked to describe sitting to encourage people to come to his sesshin at the new year. And I sat at this crowded table, everybody eating and drinking and having a great time and trying to explain meditation? I mean, you can't do it. And Joe suggested that we sit for a little while, so we sat for 4 minutes, but it wasn't the right venue for it at all. And I don't know that anybody got it. Everybody started shifting around right away. It was not such a great success from my point of view. But that's what it's like. I think that's why we have a quiet place to sit. We really have to have that. Yeah. Well, we don't have anything else to study tomorrow, next week, unless somebody chooses something tonight. There's the Heart Sutra, which we haven't done in a while. There's Katagiri's book on time, and I cannot remember the title of that book. It's one of my favorites. It's such a good book. What is it?
Maybe time is the universe, or I think that's what it's called. I just bought it and I don't remember the title. I think it was time is the universe.
Time is the universe, that's it. Yeah. It's a wonderful book. And then there's Sandokai, which is always fine to study. There's the Lotus Sutra, which is a great big book with all kinds of fabulous stories in it, fairy tales kind of. There's Dogen. Dogen does time. Dogen has a great chapter on time. Uji, being time. Yeah, which is what the book is based on. Yeah, thank you, Violet. Wendy?
Well, given that it's after 8, maybe we can discuss this
next week.
Next week.
All right.
Or in any other possibilities.
Right. You may just go to the bookstore and see what falls into your hand. That's always a magical way of finding something to read or to study. Something you really, really need. And it's right there. So, okay. And I'll bring some kind of little Dharma talk to fill in the gap or something. We'll see. Bring some suggestions anyway. Okay? Do I have 1 minute sit?